Hello to our listeners. Welcome to the Women Governance Trailblazers podcast, where we listen to the journeys of trailblazing women in the corporate governance field, their passions, their struggles, and commitment to improving how companies and boards function. My name is Courtney Camlett, and my co-host is Liz Dungey.
Hi, everyone.
Liz and I are both super passionate about governance, and we want to spotlight some of the amazing women who share that passion. We love connecting with guests from different paths and industries to hear their perspectives on what surprised them in their career and where they think the field of corporate governance is going. For this episode, we're delighted to be talking with Una Choi. Una serves as a Senior Vice President, Global Head of Regulatory Operations at NASDAQ. She manages the US and European listing qualifications and trading surveillance teams, where she supports the goals of facilitating capital formation, maintaining fair and orderly markets, and protecting investors. Among other responsibilities, she manages multidisciplinary teams responsible for assessing the qualification of listed companies and their continued compliance with NASDAQ listing standards. Prior to joining NASDAQ, Una advised business leaders and boards in her roles as in-house counsel at Willis Towers Watson and Northrop Grumman. In these roles, she was also responsible for leading complex projects and managing legal matters related to domestic and international M&A, antitrust, venture capital, and strategic alliances. Una has also served as a senior executive at the Securities and Exchange Commission. During her tenure, she managed and significantly expanded a new office mandated by the Dodd-Frank Act that performed examinations, risk monitoring, and data analytics related to the asset management industry. Prior to joining the SEC, Una was a partner at Hogan Lovells, and she started her career on Wall Street as an analyst at Goldman Sachs. Whew, that is quite the career. Una, we are thrilled to get to speak with you. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Courtney and Liz. I'm a big fan of yours, so it's really great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, our pleasure. So as Courtney detailed, you have quite the impressive background. You've really done it all. You've been on Wall Street, private practice, you're at the SEC, and now you're in the senior leadership role at NASDAQ. How has your corporate governance, M&A, and securities regulatory skill set contributed to your success in all of these various roles?
I've been very lucky to have had all these experiences in my career. They've been essential building blocks for the responsibilities I now have at NASDAQ, which I think is quite unique. When I started as a young analyst at Goldman, I got exposed to investment banking and the trading world. And this gave me a general sense of market structure and dynamics. And that exposure boosted my confidence in my early years as a corporate attorney because it provided me with a holistic understanding of IPOs, securities offerings, M&A transactions, proxy contests, what have you, in ways where law school training just alone couldn't provide. And then as a securities lawyer in private practice, you learn to pay attention to the details and master the ins and outs of the 33 Act, 34 Act requirements. But it was really when I was at the SEC, that's where I came to understand the importance of articulating policy goals and striving for a sound and thoughtful regulatory framework that ultimately impacts, the economy, market participants, companies, and investors. And I think about corporate governance in that same way, where you build and develop a technical framework for sound decision making while keeping your eye on the overall goal and mission of your organization. So I think it's that balance between technical proficiency and the ability to see the bigger picture that is so important and helpful. And last but not least, I think M&A is a discipline that really goes beyond critical legal thinking, especially when you're leading it in-house. It involves understanding various aspects of the company, the board, ultimate goals and strategy for transformative change. And when you are doing M&A deals, you have to work closely with other team members in business, operations, finance, treasury, what have you. And it's all about bringing their perspectives together and identifying key points and issues. And to do this effectively, I think one needs to have a working level understanding of a wide range of those functional areas, perspectives, and priorities. So being able to articulate that in a common language, especially in this, to the C-suite and in front of the board, is critical for success. And I think these M&A skills can easily be translated into skills for any leadership role. So I'm, very happy to say that here at NASSEC, I get to express all of my professional DNA, building on the experiences and knowledge gained while working closely with private and public companies, boards, financial institutions, regulators, and investors.
I was going to say M&A gives you an incredibly broad reach, and it's the least insular sort of function in the organization because you do have to work across so many groups.
Absolutely. And it's really about, trying to make sure that the team thinks about it in a positive sum game and is all sort of rowing towards that common goal. And as you know, M&A can be really intense. Sometimes it's 24/7, especially when you're getting close to that, signing phase or closing phase. So you need everybody to sort of, be thinking about things in a very sort of focused, but in a unified way. So it's a challenge, but it's a fun challenge.
I was just going to say, NASDAQ and the companies listed on NASDAQ are lucky to have someone at the helm in this role who has such a broad array of expertise because it can take years. It's kind of like the fable of the elephant where each person is touching their part and nobody can see the big picture. So to have somebody in your position who has been through all that and sees the big picture as well as the small details. I mean, that's pretty unique.
Yeah, I mean, I've been very lucky, as I have said, to have all of these experiences. And, it wasn't all planned, but I'm glad to sort of be at a place where I am now 30 years, looking back in my career to be able to have all those sort of building blocks. It's been really helpful for me.
Yeah, it set you up to be very agile.
Absolutely. Yeah. You have to kind of pivot and navigate in ways that you didn't quite expect, but it also makes those challenges easier to deal with. So you're not kind of afraid of those challenges. You kind of learn to embrace them after a time.
So, have you always had that mindset, or is there a particular mindset that you've developed that has helped you adapt to new organizations and roles and dealing with different people?
Yeah, my approach to new experiences has been greatly influenced by my early years. So when I was in the fifth grade, my family moved from Seoul, South Korea, to the small town of Springfield, Missouri. And transitioning from one of the largest cities in the world to the Ozarks, was a significant change. And assimilating into a completely different culture and learning a new language allowed me to kind of look forward to exploring beyond what I already, know and developing that growth mindset. And during college, I had the opportunity to study in Europe, which further helped me adapt to different cultures and ways of thinking. So although, these early experiences weren't always easy, in my career journey, I have enjoyed and sometimes actively sought out, being in different environments. Honing my legal skills at a large law firm, learning to navigate politics and policy and government service, and helping to drive strategic goals with global businesses. And I think that all of these experiences have provided me with unique professional opportunities and also pushed me to be open-minded about different practices and institutional values. And of course, along the way, I got to work with, diverse set of colleagues from different backgrounds, with different skill sets, lawyers, accountants, data scientists, asset managers, and different types of leaders. So the mindset, of going beyond what I already know and understanding others' perspectives and priorities all have helped me tremendously in quickly adapting to new roles and organizations.
Very inspiring. Thank you for sharing that background. Most of NASDAQ's corporate governance listing standards have been in place for quite some time. They don't come as a surprise anymore to companies who are seeking an initial listing, or we hope that they don't anyway, if they've been adequately prepared. But in your view, are there any topics or rules that companies continue to find challenging? And also, do you have advice to companies that are thinking about going public on how they can set themselves up for success in complying with the continued listing standards?
Sure. In my role, I have the opportunity and privilege to engage with a wide variety of private and public companies. And of course, being at NASDAQ, NASDAQ's key role as a public equities market is to help connect investors with companies for capital formation and access to investment options. And what I often hear about actually isn't really related to any specific challenges to the listing rules, but rather the burdens of being a public company due to increasing disclosure requirements, antiquated proxy process, and litigation challenges. And those challenges have and are preventing, a large number of ready companies from going public. So just to give you a historical perspective, over the past 25 years, the number of public companies listed on US exchanges overall, the number has declined 36% from 7,000 to about 4,500, while the number of private equity-backed companies in the US actually has increased almost 500%, from 2,000 to 11,500. So, in addressing these concerns from companies of all sizes, we NASDAQ published a policy advocacy paper a few weeks back. It's very recently focusing on certain specific recommendations for the policymakers to, modernize proxy process, scale disclosure obligations, ranging all the way from like right sizing Reg SK requirements to rethinking, a variety of different filer qualifications, and perhaps even streamlining quarterly reporting practices. So I would love to encourage companies and advisors to take a look at our white paper for details on, our various recommendations. And, in terms of recommendations for the companies, obviously, just thinking through the best practices, having a solid foundation in corporate governance, working closely with your advisors to set up that foundation in the right way, I think is absolutely critical. I as a junior lawyer, I did a lot of work, pre-diligence work for companies wanting to go through the IPO process, and I just remember spending, hours looking at the cap table and making sure everything was lined up correctly. And, there are many instances where, oh gosh, if they had just thought about this, from the get-go, from the beginning, then we wouldn't have to go back, and try to fix something. And that can be kind of challenging. So I think trying to do the right things in the beginning, as you go along, at that point in time, will set up everyone for success when they decide to undertake an IPO.
Yeah, the numbers you gave about the number of companies that are public versus private and the growth versus sort of the shrinking is very interesting. And regulatory burden these days is really a thing. And
It really is. I mean, I hear it from companies of all sizes, whether, it's a small biotech company who recently became a public company versus the largest companies in the world. And, they have their concerns are different, but the underlying theme is really the same, I think.
yeah, it's like doing a small M&A deal versus a large M&A deal. Sometimes it's harder for the smaller ones than it is for the larger ones.
Absolutely.
And the paper can be found on NASDAQ's website. We also blogged about it on the corporatecouncil.net.
Yes.
And it's very, it's great recommendations, very holistic, because as those of us in the space know, and as you know better than anyone, Una, this stuff is all interconnected and it's really a whole ecosystem and it all needs a bit of modernization and improvement to hopefully bring back the appeal of going public, even if you're not a billion-dollar company yet.
Exactly. I mean, I'm really optimistic with sort of the renewed focus with the new SEC under the new leadership of Chairman, Atkins. I think there's going to be a lot of momentum around capital formation. So we really try to sort of come up with practical recommendations for them to consider, and not just the SEC, but Congress as well.
So I'll say one of your superpowers seems to be collaboration. And you frequently collaborate with regulators and exchanges worldwide. How do global regulatory developments influence NASDAQ's approach to governance? And what emerging policies or initiatives should boards, council, and investors be paying attention to?
What a great question and a timely one, too. Yes, engaging and collaborating with regulators and exchanges around the world is a big part of my job, and I really, really do enjoy it. You get to see how different countries and different environments are thinking about, the same issues, capital formation, efficient and orderly markets and investor protection. And with that said, it also makes me realize how complex and intertwined the global financial ecosystem really is. And I think we are seeing the effects of that in recent weeks. NASDAQ itself certainly has a unique vantage point at the intersection of financial markets, technology, and regulations. And right now, we are in a highly dynamic policy environment. So I am sure that every company is focused on addressing and preparing for continuing developments with various trade policies and beyond. My own personal views are that Gen AI and regulatory framework around that will develop very, very quickly. Companies should also be thinking about and preparing for 24-hour trading of their securities, given that several US exchanges, including NASDAQ, have announced plans to move forward with overnight trading. And digital assets and tokenization will be an area that will move very, very fast. There is a tremendous level of momentum supporting innovation in this area, and I think regulatory framework will start to develop very, very quickly and with a lot of urgency.
One question on the 24-hour trading. So that sounds like none of us will be sleeping ever for those of us who are involved with disclosures. How do you think that that will affect practices in terms of like the time of day that earnings are issued and things like that? Will people still wait until traditional market hours, or just will it be more of a free-for-all?
I think there would be a certain practices and customs and order that'll be applied to the 24-hour trading. And I think those topics are all being discussed with different industry groups. And NASDAQ, in particular, is working with constituents from, both from the trading side and the issuer side, just to make sure that we're getting everybody's perspectives on that. So to be determined, but I think everybody who's thinking about this thoughtfully is trying to make sure that the protections that are in the regular hours trading is carried over to the overnight trading.
Yeah, that's reassuring. I'm not that I doubted it, but it's good to hear that from you as well.
Absolutely.
So, as has been a theme in this podcast and this discussion, we have covered just all of the impressive aspects of your career and how you've done so much. And Courtney and I were curious what role mentorship has played along the way in your career, and also how do you support and mentor the next generation?
I mean, mentorship, sponsorship, networking are so important in the success of our careers, and I've certainly benefited from those relationships. And they take time and investment on both sides to make it meaningful and engaging, but it's so worth it and can pay off in ways that you don't even expect. And someone that you have worked with 25 years ago can come into your life and really sort of be able to be that sounding board and support. So I think it's really important for, I mean, I tell, people that I work with who are in the earlier days of their career to really go out there and develop those relationships because they're really, really important and meaningful. And in terms of supporting the next generation of leaders, I am an executive sponsor of NASDAQ's Asian Employee Resource Group, and I have an open door policy with everyone on my team to discuss career development and also actively mentor a number of colleagues outside of my group and some outside of NASDAQ itself. And one thing I do tell everyone that I'm mentoring is that this is a two-way relationship. And while I certainly will provide guidance and advice, I also ask them to do the same back. So, and that I appreciate their feedback and their advice. And it's really helpful to have a sounding board for myself so that they feel like they're vested in this relationship, that they feel like they can provide value, and that their opinions, thoughts, and analysis and assessments are really important to me. And so overall, I found that this approach makes the relationship that much deeper, more symbiotic, and that much more meaningful.
I really
That's,
like that.
yeah, it's so important too. And I like the two-way street.
yeah, I think it's just, sometimes people think about mentorships as like, one person is receiving and the other person is giving. But I do think that it strengthens that relationship. And I've certainly been in situations where that mentorship roles switch over time too. And so why not just start with that mutual sort of aspect of it from the get-go?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Una, for being on the show. It was so much fun and very interesting to talk with you today.
Yes,
Thank
thank
you so
you.
much. It was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for having me.
For those who are listening, we want to thank you as well. Please subscribe to Women Governance Trailblazers on whatever platform you use for podcasts. We would love it if you would rate us while you're there. And in addition, if you know a woman governance trailblazer who you think would be a great guest on this show, feel free to ping Courtney or me on either LinkedIn or by email. Thanks, everyone.